The Gospel of John has been called the most unique, the most profound, the most amazing, and really the most explicit book of the Bible. And this morning we're just going to kind of get an introduction. We're really not going to get into the text of the book itself so much today. More is just getting an introduction into the book. We're going to look at the book itself. We'll look at the author of this book, who wrote it. Of course, we all know it was the Apostle John, but there are many conflicting views out there, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But the book itself is unique from any of the other four Gospels in many, many ways. And this is one of the things that caused some theologians, some scholars, to criticize the book as though it couldn't really have been written by one of the apostles because it really didn't draw from any of the apostles. There's a whole field of theology out there, scholarship, called source criticism, where they want to look at a particular text of the Bible and try to find similarities between it and other books or other texts in the Bible. And they'll say, oh, well, this author must have used this book as a source, or he must have used this other author as a source for his material. And this type of thinking just undermines the inspiration of the Bible. And John, it's very clear through the text of the Gospel of John that John was an eyewitness to all the events that he describes here. He was part of Jesus' inner circle from the very beginning. So why does an eyewitness need to use other sources for what he is writing? He's writing from his own personal experience. But it's hard to date the writing of the Gospel of John. John's Gospel makes no mention of the destruction of Jerusalem, but that doesn't mean he couldn't have written it after the fact, because he describes in detail many geographical, many architectural features of the city of Jerusalem. So he's obviously an eyewitness. He's very familiar with Palestinian geography, Palestinian locations and places. But the best guesses that people have made seems to date the writing of the book right around 70 to 90 A.D. It would be hard to put it much earlier than that, and it would be hard to put it much later than that. As a matter of fact, there's a papyrus, a fragment called P52. P just means papyrus, 52 is the number of papyrus, but a fragment of the Gospel of John, a fragment from chapter 18, that has been dated to about 130 to 135 A.D., and this fragment was actually found in Egypt. So when you consider, if this was written between 70 and 90 A.D., that means it would have been copied and disseminated and found its way to Egypt within just a matter of 20 or 30, 40 years at the most. So it was obviously written fairly early, certainly before 100 A.D. Also, the Gospel of John is the only gospel, only one of the four gospels, that explicitly identifies Jesus as God. All the other gospels will allude to it, and it's implicit in there. But the Gospel of John is the only gospel that explicitly states Jesus is God. Jesus is Messiah, the Son of God. And of course, this is in perfect keeping with John's purpose statement. John has a purpose statement in his gospel. He tells us exactly why he wrote it. In John chapter 20, verse 31, John writes, "But these things have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name." So that's the purpose that John wrote this, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. He is deity. Now the question is, within that purpose statement, is John writing this primarily as an evangelistic letter, writing to unbelievers to convince them that Jesus is the Son of God, or is he writing this to believers to confirm them and to strengthen their faith? And a lot of the argument around that hinges on whether The word in John 20:31, the word believe, is in what's known as the aorist tense, which points to a point in time, or the present tense, which points to continuous activity. The bulk of manuscript evidence seems to point to that John used the present tense here, where he is saying, "These things I have written so that you may continue to believe, that you may keep on believing that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God." It was written to strengthen the belief of existing believers. Because at this particular time in church history, the church was being infiltrated. The church was being attacked by many, many false doctrines, particularly false doctrines concerning the deity of Jesus Christ. Gnosticism was beginning to rise, which, again, just an anti-Christian heresy, that Gnosticism, just in its basic form, believed that everything that was material is evil, everything spiritual is good, and therefore God can never take on a material body, a human body, because the body is evil. And so Jesus just appeared to be human, which was one form of Gnosticism. But there's another form of Gnosticism that was particularly rampant during John's time, and it was called Cerinthian Gnosticism. It was named after a man called Cerinthus. Matter of fact, there's even a story that Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, supposedly told that John and Polycarp walked into a bathhouse in Ephesus and saw Cerinthus in the bathhouse, and John said, "Let us flee from here, unless the roof falls in on us, because the enemy of God is in here." And so Cerinthus propagated a heresy that said that the person Jesus, the man Jesus, was just a man, but that Christ descended on Jesus in the form of a dove at his baptism and then left Jesus right prior to his crucifixion, so that the man Jesus, Jesus Christ, was not a deity, but that Christ came on the man Jesus at his baptism, left him at his crucifixion. And this was Cerinthian heresy. And John is dealing with this particular heresy also in his first gospel. And so there's all these attacks coming against the church at this time. And so John, more than likely, and again, you can't say this dogmatically, but more than likely, John is writing this gospel to affirm Christians in the fact that Jesus is indeed the Son of God. He is the Messiah. There's plenty of evidence to support that Jesus was who he said he was, and that who John said he was and is. Now, there's also a question, is was this written to a Jewish or to a Gentile audience? Some think it was written primarily to a Jewish audience. Some think primarily to a Gentile, but I think the majority of evidence points that it was probably predominantly Gentile audience, because to get into the letter, we'll see that John has to explain many Jewish customs. He explains and identifies certain geographic areas within Palestine. And so he does this. He wouldn't have to do this for a Jewish audience, but he does for a Gentile audience to explain these particular Jewish customs. The Gospel of John also contains material that's not found in the other Gospels. Really, an enormous amount of material is found in John that is not contained in the other Gospels. Chapters 1 and 2 are not found in the other Gospels. You have the wedding in Cana in chapter 2. You have Jesus' account with Nicodemus in chapter 3 that are not in any of the other Gospels. You have Jesus' account with the woman at the well that are not in any of the other Gospels in chapter 4. You have the healing of the paralytic at Bethsaida, which is not in any of the other accounts. You have the feeding of the 5,000, which is also in some of the other accounts, but there's the long discourse that follows the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6, where Jesus talks about, "I'm the bread of life, and no man can come to me unless the Father himself draws me." And Jesus talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, and many of his disciples left him at that time. See, Jesus wasn't interested in attracting a crowd. And he always was setting up barriers for people because he wanted them to understand that it wasn't their work that brought them into the kingdom. So there's that long discourse after the feeding of the 5,000. There's Jesus' discourse about being living water in chapter 7. There's the discourse about the seed of Abraham in chapter 8. There's the healing of the man born blind. There's Jesus teaching on the Good Shepherd in chapter 9. The raising of Lazarus is not in any of the other Gospels. John chapter 11. There's the washing of the disciples' feet in the upper room is not found in any of the other Gospels. There's the whole upper room discourse in chapters 13, 14, 15, 16. There's Jesus' high priestly prayer in chapter 17. And then John gives details of the death and the resurrection of Jesus that are not found in any of the other Gospels. For example, he tells that Jesus was first taken to Annas' house before he was taken to the high priest's house, Caiaphas' house. All the other Gospels have Jesus taken directly to Caiaphas. Whereas John says he's first taken to Annas before Caiaphas. And it's because John is an eyewitness. If you remember, Peter and John were the only disciples to follow Jesus from the garden to the high priest's residence where Jesus was tried by the Jews. And John was the only disciple who knew the high priest and knew the servants within the high priest's home. He actually got Peter admitted to the courtyard of the high priest. But John himself was actually inside with Jesus during the trial. Then, the Gospel of John also contains, in the first 11 chapters, 7 signs. There are 7 signs that Jesus does to show that He is the Messiah, or that John uses to point that Jesus is the Messiah in keeping with His purpose statement. The first sign is Jesus changing water into wine. He even tells us in verse 11 of chapter 2, "This beginning of His signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee." And then His second sign was when Christ heals the nobleman's son. And He did this from a distance, again, pointing to the deity. Jesus didn't have to be there to lay hands on him. The nobleman came to Jesus, told him, "My son is sick." Jesus said, "Go, your son is well." And we learn that this was even over a day's journey away, because He inquired of them the hour when His son began to get better, and they said therefore to him, "Yesterday, at the 7th hour, the fever left him." So this was over a day's journey away that Jesus healed this son. This was the second sign. The third sign, chapter 5, Jesus healing the paralytic man. The fourth sign, Jesus feeding the 5,000. The fifth sign, Jesus walking on the water. The sixth sign, again, was Jesus healing the blind man in chapter 9. The man born blind, who was over 40 years old. Remember, the paralytic He healed had been over 38 years. So just showing that these were divine supernatural acts. And the seventh sign, of course, the raising of Lazarus. And then there are also 7 I am statements within the Gospel of John, clearly pointing to Jesus as God. It's echoing God's self-declaration of Himself in Exodus to Moses, "I am who I am." In chapter 6, verse 35, remember Jesus in chapter 6 is talking about, "I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life that came down from heaven." In chapter 8, verse 12, "I am the light of the world." In chapter 10, verse 9 and 11, Jesus is the door. He's the door to the sheepfold. In chapter 11, when He's speaking with Mary, "I am the resurrection and the life." when he's speaking of Philip in the upper room in chapter 14, verse 6, I am the resurrection and the life. And in chapter 15, I am the vine, you are the branches. So there are these seven I am statements that point to the deity of Jesus. But not only does John include or have a lot of material that's not found in the other Gospels, John also omits a lot of material that are found in the other Gospels. For instance, there's no birth account of Jesus. There's no genealogy of Jesus. There's no account of Jesus' childhood. There's no temptation by Satan in John's Gospel. There's no Sermon on the Mount in John's Gospel. There are no parables in John's Gospel. Instead, there are long discourses, long teachings by Jesus. There's no casting out of demons in John's Gospel. And there's no institution of the Lord's Supper in John's Gospel. So all of these things are omitted from John's. And it just shows that John's purpose was somewhat different. The other Gospels tended to be more evangelistic in nature. Matthew was written by a Jew to Jews. And it was done to show that Jesus was indeed the promised Messiah. And it was more evangelistic in nature. Mark's Gospel was written predominantly to a Roman audience in Rome, to a Gentile audience, but it's predominantly evangelistic in nature. Same with Luke's Gospel. Whereas John's Gospel is written not so much for evangelistic purposes, but to confirm believers in their faith. There's also evidence that John omitted a lot of these accounts that are in the other Gospels, because he knew that his readers would have already been familiar with these other accounts. For instance, in John chapter 3, verse 24, John writes, in talking about John the Baptist, in verse 24 he writes, "For John had not yet been thrown into prison." Kind of assuming that the readers would have understood or known that at some time John would have been thrown into prison, that they were familiar with that account of John. Also in chapter 11, verse 2, John writes, beginning in verse 1, talking about Lazarus, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha, and it was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So in other words, referring to this person, a past event in her life, as though the audience that's reading it would have been familiar with it already. You remember, this was the Mary that anointed Jesus' feet with her hair. This is the one I'm talking about that you've read about in these previous Gospels. Also in John 18, verse 13, John gives the account of them leading him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. In other words, He's somewhat correcting the impression that the other Gospels had given that he was taken to Caiaphas first. But John comes back and says, actually, he was taken to Annas first, not Caiaphas. So there's, again, you can't be dogmatic about this, but there seems to be indications that John knew that his readership would have been familiar with the other four Gospels. And again, this is perfectly consistent. If you consider that John's Gospel was probably one of the last letters, last Gospels written, it was certainly written probably after Paul had written most of his epistles. And even Paul writes, Paul, in writing to Timothy and talking about how you're to take care of and support the teachers and the elders and how you relate to the elders, in verse 18 of chapter 5, Paul writes, "For the Scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing." Well, that's a quote from Deuteronomy 25:4. But then he says, "The laborer is worthy of his wages." Well, where did Paul get that from? Well, that's a quote from Luke chapter 10, verse 7. So Paul is quoting Luke's Gospel right here. So Paul is obviously familiar with Luke's Gospel, which means that Luke's Gospel is probably circulating among the other churches. And the churches, by the time John writes his gospel, would have been familiar with these other ones. So that's why John is able to omit a lot of what's found in the other gospels. Then also something that's unique to John's gospel is that John spends 9 chapters of his gospel, chapters 13 through 19, on a period of less than 24 hours in the life of Jesus, from the upper room discourse to the crucifixion. When you consider that Jesus' earthly ministry encompassed a period of 3 years, around 3 years, but yet John takes 7 of his 21 chapters and focuses, you know, a third of his epistle focusing on a period of time less than 24 hours in the life of Jesus to show that this is indeed the Messiah. It's all designed to uphold, to prove that this person, Jesus, this Jesus of Nazareth, this person that was born in Bethlehem to Mary and Joseph, was indeed the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, that He was deity, that He was God in the flesh. And that John himself believed it, and that he was an eyewitness to it. Now again, there have been many, many attempts by what's called higher criticism to try to disprove John's authorship. They want to put it somewhere even into the second century, saying, oh, this is just an accumulation of Christian tradition that's been passed down and elaborated on over the period of time to elevate this person, Jesus, and eventually became deity in the minds of the church. This didn't really happen this way. This was just Christian tradition that evolved over time before it was eventually written down. But all of these forms of higher criticism are just born out of pure unbelief, and it's born out of pure intellectual pride. Again, if we were to get a newspaper, go buy 2 different newspapers today, and each newspaper had an account of an automobile accident, and there were some differences in each newspaper's account, would we say that, oh, this newspaper must use that newspaper for a source for its article? Well, of course not. They're just written from 2 different perspectives. And we would never say that this newspaper used that newspaper for the source for their article. But that's what all these higher critics say. They don't think somebody in the ancient world actually had a memory that they could remember and call to mind all these things that happened, not to mention the fact that Jesus told the disciples in his upper room discourse that the Holy Spirit would come upon them and would bring to mind everything he had spoken to them, and he would show them what was going to take place. So it's just a denial of the supernatural. It's born out of unbelief and intellectual pride. John is clearly the author. Church tradition holds up John as clearly being the author. John's gospel is unique in its construction, it's unique in its purpose, it's unique in how it presents its material. And that kind of brings us to John the Apostle himself. Within this gospel, John is never mentioned by name. He'll refer to himself as the apostle that Jesus loved, but he never refers to himself by name. So we know from the other Gospels, we can learn a lot about the Apostle John just from the other 3 Gospels. We know that John was the younger brother of the Apostle James. We know from John chapter 1 that John was one of 2 of the very first apostles, John and Andrew, who had been disciples of John the Baptist. When John the Baptist testified concerning Jesus, they went and followed Jesus. See, John was not interested in just being part of a personality cult. John was interested in the truth. And that's what we're going to see as we get more into the gospel. John has often been called the apostle of love, but he could just as easily be called the apostle of truth, because John is so black and white when it comes to the presentation of the truth. But John was one of the first, one of the 2 first disciples. He was part of the inner circle, the three of Peter, James, and John, who were with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. John was one of the 12 apostles that were with Jesus from the very beginning of his ministry. And again, a former disciple of John. John was also the only apostle to die a natural death. The only one that wasn't martyred. But yeah, he lived a long life, but he also suffered a lot. While his fellow apostles were in glory, he was still on this earth suffering. Suffering on the island of Patmos when he wrote Revelation, suffering at the hands of heretics, suffering at the hands of the Roman Empire. But church history, for the most part, and church tradition, places John's death somewhere in his mid-90s. He was probably in his early to mid-90s when he died. He was an old man. In fact, Irenaeus, in his church history, states that John had to be carried into the church. He became so infirm that he had to be carried into the church. And he constantly was saying, "Little children, love one another. Little children, love one another." And when he was asked why he said this, he would say, "Because it was Jesus' command, and if it's Jesus' command, it's good enough." And that's what he focused on. But John wasn't always that way. John was the youngest of the 12 disciples. He was probably about 16 years old when he first started following Jesus. He was a Palestinian Jew, steeped in Judaism. As I said, John is often called the Apostle of Love, but he could just as easily be called the Apostle of Truth. He uses the word love about 80 times in his gospel and epistles, but he uses the word truth about 25 times just in the Gospel of John and about 20 times in his other epistles for a total of about 45 times. And that's because John is just so black and white. John deals in absolutes. You're of light or you're of darkness. You're either of truth or you're of a lie. You're the child of God or you're a child of Satan. You're either of God or you're of the world. There's no gray areas with John. John is just black and white, cut and dry. Truth was John's passion. And we see this reiterated over and over, not just in this gospel, but in 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, where in 1 John, John is talking about distinguishing the truth from error, walking in the light, being children of light, and rejecting anything that's of darkness. In 2 John, he's warning this particular church not to associate with false teachers. And in 3 John, he's encouraging them to accept and support true teachers. So he was always concerned with the truth. We don't fraternize. We don't accommodate. We don't compromise with error. Truth is all. John was passionate for the truth. But John was also very zealous early on in his life. He was very impetuous. He was a very bigoted, prejudiced person. Remember, what did he want to do when the Samaritans refused to let Jesus come through their area? "Shall we call down fire from heaven now on him and destroy him?" He was very ambitious and prideful. Who asked to sit one at Jesus' right and one at his left? James and John, right? The two brothers, the sons of thunder, Jesus named them, because they were so boisterous. They didn't hold anything back. It was Peter and James and John who were discussing with themselves along the road who would be the greatest in the kingdom. And Jesus knew what they were talking about, and he even asked them, "What are you discussing?" And they were embarrassed to answer him. John wanted to sit either at Jesus' left or right, and James wanted to sit at either the other. John, just simply, he was passionate for the truth, but John lacked love for others. He lacked compassion for others. And this was something that John had to learn. Also, in the other three Gospels, we see that John is rarely by himself or speaking for himself. The only place in the Gospels that John is recorded as speaking is when he asked Jesus, "Shall we call down fire from heaven?" The rest of the time, John is usually hanging out with Peter and James. He's part of the inner circle, but he's not the head of the inner circle. That would be Peter. But as John grew, John matured, he learned to balance truth and love. Now, it's believed that, again, John, I think John learned this lesson so well, that even at the cross, John is the only apostle that the Bible records as being an eyewitness to the crucifixion. Remember, all the other apostles scattered at the garden. Peter and John went with Jesus to the trial, but then Peter denied him and went away and wept bitterly. John is the only apostle as being recorded as an eyewitness to the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. And he's the only one there at the cross that Jesus turns to and says, "Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother." Jesus gave John care of his mother. And church tradition holds that John stayed in Jerusalem taking care of Mary until the death of Mary. And after Mary's death, John became the pastor of the church in Ephesus. You see, in Galatians, you remember when we were in Galatians, Paul is referring to his visit to Jerusalem 14 years after his conversion. And who does he say he saw there? In verse 9 of chapter 2, "In recognizing the grace that had been given to me, James and Cephas," that's Peter, "and John, who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship." So John is still in Jerusalem here, 14, 15 years after the crucifixion. But he does become the pastor of the church in Ephesus. And he pastors that church until he's exiled to the island of Patmos. But he has influence over not just the church in Ephesus, but over all the churches in Asia, because he wrote those seven letters to the churches in Asia. Now, if there's one thing the Gospel of John is going to teach us, is that truth and love are not incompatible. You know, besides the purpose statement of proving that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and nobody can read the Gospel of John without coming to that conclusion unless they're blinded. Blinded by the God of this world so that they may not believe the glorious light of the Gospel of Jesus Christ. Because it's irrefutable. Again, the Gospel of John is a wonderful Gospel to take Jehovah's Witness to because of the I Am statements, because of all the expositions of the deity of Christ, because Jehovah's Witnesses deny the deity of Christ. Mormons deny the deity of Christ. But John teaches us that truth and love are not incompatible. And those who compromise truth are not loving. You hear so much today in the church about, we're a loving church. We're a compassionate church. We're an accepting church. Hey, just come as you are. But usually it's come as you are and leave as you came. Because there's no truth taught. There's no doctrine taught. That's not loving. A loving church is not a church that just comes along and puts their... It's not ooey-gooey sentimentality. That is not Christian love. It's not indulgent. True love does not compromise the truth. It doesn't give people a false hope and a false sense of security by telling them because you prayed a prayer or walked an aisle or signed a card that you're a believer, or that you went through some type of religious ceremony, you're now a believer. That's not Christian. Christian, love. Love and truth go hand in hand. Truth without love is just legalism, it's arrogance. Whereas love without truth is just sentimentality and it's liberalism. So what we're going to see from John as we get into it is that John teaches us that truth and love are not incompatible. In fact, they're inseparable. You can't have one without the other. And today, sadly, the vast majority of the church thinks it's loving, but it's not, because there's no truth. There's no truth. It's just a shallow, superficial shell. There's no depth. There's no truth. I remember even reading one church's website where it states, hey, we got people in the church who are Arminians. We have some that are Calvinists. You know, it really doesn't matter what you believe. We're just all here to come together and love on one another and support one another. It doesn't really matter what you believe. Well, that's not love, and that's not the church. That's just a social club. That's not the church. Truth and love are inseparable. And John is the apostle of truth just as much as he's the apostle of love. It's either this way or it's that way. You're either in the world or you're of God. You're either light or you're dark.